Okay, ladies, let's make a start. We are on sheet number 35, which means we're pretty much halfway through. I'm aiming for 70. See if we have enough weeks left to get to 70, but we're on number 35. How did the Mishnah become the Mishnah that we know and love? One of the things that I strongly suggest that you do at some stage is to get into learning Mishnayos. I give a Mishnayos Chabura here on a Tuesday lunchtime. I'll see if we can get it restarted now this new semester. But learning Mishnayos gives you, it's like bite-sized chunks giving you an overview of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. So many people just don't have that overview, and it's a big chaval. They know a little bit about what they know, but Kochim and Taharas, think of this, Kochim and Taharas, which together make nearly half the Mishnah, are completely off the radar screen for most people. Which means that half the Torah Sheba'al Peh is just not something that they relate to. That's a problem. And therefore, at some stage, I strongly suggest you get into learning Mishnayos. There are various ways to make that easier these days. There are Peirushim, which are easily accessible. And I can advise you where to start. A couple of girls have already spoken to me about it. A couple of girls are already doing Mishnayos. It's a good thing to do, especially with the skills that you learn here in MMY. Mishnah is something you can really get your teeth into. It's much easier than Gemara. And I recommend that as a limud between you and a chavrusa going forward. If you want to learn stuff, then that is definitely something that we can talk about. Now, we have this strange source in the Gemara that talks about the original Mishnah, quote unquote, being 600 or 700 mesechtas. Have a look here, number one. Pligubah rapapa v'rabonon. Chad amar sheish meya sidrei Mishnah. There were 600 not just mesechtas. There were 600 sedarim of Mishnah. And there were, one other says there were 700 sedarim of Mishnah. Now, I don't think this means that there were hundreds of books that we lost along the way. That's not what this means, because we know that there were no books. There was no organized text of the Mishnah. What it means, I think, is, let's get rid of this stuff on the board behind us, that originally, if you were to look at what the Mishnah was in terms of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, you have this absolutely enormous quantity of Torah Sheba'al Peh through the ages, this amoeba that I draw here, of Torah Sheba'al Peh, Torah, Sheba'al Peh, and this I think is your 600/700 mesechtas, or Sidorim. And at some point that shrunk. Imagine extremely concentrated orange juice, or whatever it is. That shrunk until we produced something which was much, much smaller. Now imagine this, where like this is the Torah Sheba'al Peh. We produced, in terms of the Mishnah, something which was, if you like, a condensed version of that, and the rest of it was left non-textualized. So if you look in number two for a second, in the Ga'onim they say, Da, Miyamos Moshe Rabbeinu Ad Hillel Hazakim, from Moshe through till Hillel, Hayushesh Mayos Sidrei Mishnah, Kamoshe Nitna Makodesh Baruch Hu LaMoshe B'Sinai. There were 600 Sedarim of Mishnah, like the Oral Torah was given to Moshe on Sinai. Now, you should just know, this touches on a much bigger machlokas that we're not getting into today, which we will talk about later on. There is a major machlokas, we talked about this in first semester as well, as to whether the Torah was given in its entirety, meaning all the halachic detail was given at Sinai, or whether, as we learned, and the Rambam learned, and the Ramban learned, and others learned, that actually what was given at Sinai was given at Sinai, and there was an adding to and expansion of that Torah along the way. The Ga'onim go much more down the route that the entire Torah was given at Sinai, which is sounds like this blob was given at Sinai. So there are two separate questions going on here. One is the, if you like, the concentration of this amount down to that. And the other is how we got to this whole set of Torah Sheba'al Peh in the first place. Did it come like that, or did it come like this and go like that? Okay? I'm not getting into that now, but that's a really important machlokas. The Ga'onim of Sadi go and take the view much more that lots was given on Sinai. The Rambam takes the view that much less was given on Sinai, but the tools were there in order to expand. And we learned last semester very much in the line of the Rambam. Okay? Which makes a lot of sense in many ways. But here, for our purposes, it says that all this was given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Sinai. Umin Hillel ve'elech, from Hillel onwards, nitma'et. There was a contraction. V'nitma'fken, and there was a, like, what's a miskein? In other words, Torah had to be concentrated and contracted ha'olam. The world was becoming a weak place. V'chalsha k'void ha'shel Torah. The kavod ha'Torah was weakening because of the second base of Mikdash. The light signal mehilah v'shamay elah sheish midroi. from Hillel and Zach and Shammai. We saw this last time. Remember, we saw Rav Margolius saying that Shammai was Mishnah Rishona, Hillel was Mishnah Achrona, but they began this process of six Sedarim, which we'll talk about in a few minutes and how they work. Now, talking of Rav Margolius, let's look at number three for a second. He explains how this process of contraction works. Chavilot Mishnayot Elu, this great package of Mishnahs that he inherited, this blob that came down to Hillel and Shammai, etc. Elu Hema Chayma Shemehen Aruch Rabbeinu HaKadosh Mishnato. These are the, like, the raw material from which Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yudah Nossi, created the Mishnah. Ka'ashi Huchruch Lichtov, when he was forced to write it, we'll see that's the machlokes, whether it was written then, but Sefer Yesodi Balpeh. When he wrote, is it too cold? Are you cold?
Yeah, no, I think it's a little cold as well.
I don't want people to be cold, but I don't want people to be hot. Truth is,
we can actually turn this down a bit in a second.
Okay. Okay,
that should be a bit better.
Okay. He used this raw material to create the Mishnah. Me'ele Ashisha or Shiva Me'ot Sidrei Mishnah. From this 6/700, and I'm not getting into now why there's a machlok is 6 or 700, that's beyond today. Okay, Bira Mishnator, then he selected his Mishnayot. I'm on the second line, number three. Let's go to the end of the line. V'gam b'masechet achat, even in one Masechta, lakach lefa'amim perek shalem mishnato chacham kodem. This is very important. The Mishnah that we ended up with, the Mishnah Achrona, was sometimes lifted, large parts were lifted from existing previous versions of the Mishnah. We saw that there was the Shammai Mishnah, the Hillel Mishnah. When he came on to make the final version of the Mishnah, sometimes he just took entire chunks that were already formulated in that way and plot them into the Mishnah as they were. Why didn't he change them? Because they were already known in this way. He, together with the Chachamim of the Beis Vad, of his committee, in other words, the Mishnah wasn't just one man. It was an entire yeshiva of Tamidi Chachamim over a large period of decades that produced this Mishnah. They added to this basic original format, which according to what seemed to them, la halachot to be the halacha. The karu hadvarim b'stam. And here we have the concept of stam mishnah. What's a stam mishnah? A mishnah without attribution. That's very fancy language, and it's true. Okay, a mishnah with no attribution, meaning it doesn't say Rabbi X, Rabbi Y. They produce this concept of stam. La ashegam dafan hichriya kamosam. And he says a stam mishnah meant that they pass in that way. And by the way, a stam mishnah, when you're learning mishnayos, has a lot of force in halacha. We say, oh, a stam mishnah. If you can find a shita, a position in halacha which is supported by a stam mishnah, that makes a difference. Or shevu halacha im shein al shein oisa chacham. Or they sometimes bring the halacha in the name of a particular chacham, b'chadei l'ha'ir sheyesh lismoch alav b'shachatchak, to show that you could rely on that in a situation of need. In other words, why are there minority opinions in the Mishnah? So one reason is, says Rav Margolis, so you can rely on them in times of need. Ulefanin, and sometimes, tavu gam da'as ha'yachid, sometimes they included, he crystallized, he included this view of a yachid, b'chadei levaklum, in order to show that we don't follow that, she'yedu tamin, so the tamin will know, ki rabim chalka olam, that people disagree with this. Meaning, you never know unless you know the Gemara, this is a very important point, the Mishnayos alone are this very concentrated version of Teresh Rabbah Peh. Unless you have all the rest of this stuff, which is still oral, if you like, non-textual, non-text, now it's text, because now it's Gemara. But originally, the Mishnayos themselves, you don't know how to read the Mishnah without commentary around it. In other words, the Mishnah was produced to be the most minimalist version of Teresh Rabbah Peh that was needed to protect and save the Torah, whilst not allowing you to use it as a book without reference to the oral law. Therefore, this is a perfect example. Why is there a minority opinion included in the Mishnah? Well, it could be to show you that you can rely on that in a situation of need, although it's not the l'hatchila halacha. It could be to show you that everybody disagrees with this person, you can't rely on this person, because you can see that this view was raised and thrown out. How do you know? How do you know whether this individual opinion is one that you can rely on, or is that one that you can't rely on? You need the Gemara. You need the oral law, you need the stuff around it in order to help you with this. Where's he getting this from? Yes, Nadiva.
I mean, probably the
Rome,
that would be addressed the question of how they're
able
to do this in the first place.
Oh, we haven't yet. We will do. Hold your horses. That was Abby's question last time, and she's not here now, which is a shame, because we're going to answer that question today. And you won't like the answer, Nadeva. I'm telling you that now. Okay, six. Have a look in the Mishnah, it's number six. This is the Mishnah talking about the Mishnah. Meaning it's self-referential in that sense, it talks about itself. The Mishnah in Edriyot, in number six. What's that? Right, interesting. Lama maskir in Divrei Hayachid ben Amarubin. Look at number six for a second. Why do we mention the view of the individuals together with the majority view when we usually follow the majority, right? Why do we follow the majority? Why do we follow the majority? Yes, it's a really easy answer. You've all heard of the concept in Judaism that we follow the majority. Why? I want something much more halakhic and textual. So easy, guys. Why do we follow the majority? Who made that up? Where?
Rabbis.
Who whispered that? Fagi or Avital? It's always the whisperers that get it right. Achrei Rabbim Lahatos is a posuk in Mishpatim. It's a posuk in the Torah. It's follow the majority. Although actually the posuk doesn't say follow the majority. The drash of the posuk is follow the majority. But that's where we get it from. So he says, why is it? What? Achrei Rabbim Lahatos. It's a posuk in Mishpatim. Why is it the Maskir and Divrei Hayochi ben Amarubim? When we know we follow the majority, She'im Yira says the Mishnah, because if you see based in a later based in sees as Divrei Hayochi this minority view, but Yismoch Halav and it will rely on it. It can rely on it. She'ain based in Yochel Avatel Divrei based in Chaveru Adshi Agadol Mimenu B'Chochma Minim. Because a later based in can't just override an earlier based in unless it's greater. You'll never have a greater Beis Din after the Mishnah than the Beis Din that created the Mishnah. So if it's not included in the Mishnah, then it's going to be very hard to rely on it. So they included Impedians in the Mishnah, so the later people who were on a lesser level could say, oh look, well, it's there. It's in the Mishnah already. It's there to rely on if we need to rely on it. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, in Cain, Rabbi Yehuda's view is, Lama Maskir and Dibra Hayocha Ben Amar Rabbi, why do we mention the minority together with the majority? And he says the opposite. Levakla, to rub out, to completely scrub out the minority, she'im yom ha'adam, that if later on someone should turn around and say, kach ani mekubal, this is my masora, this is what I think the halacha should be, yomala, you could then say to him, kedivrei ish ploini shamata, no, you're following this minority view, and that's not the halacha, because it's been rejected. So again, the minority is in the Mishnah sometimes to be relied upon, sometimes to show that this view is rejected, but Rabbi Yehuda Anasi wanted to create this text, whether it was oral or written, we'll see, which included all of these opinions where necessary to guide you along the way. And that's what we ended up having, which is the Mishnah, which we'll look at in specific terms soon. Now, we saw already Rav Zalman Margolis saying that, Rav Ruvi Margolis, excuse me, saying that a stem Mishnah was in a Mishnah which was without attribution, which was agreed on. Look at number four. Number four, we actually saw this source first semester. You may remember it. From the Maratz Chayes. Harbi Gezeris Nimsu Etzleinu with Mishnah Stam. We find many halachas, Drabonon, in the Mishnah Stam. The Stam Mishnahs, just like no names, just do this, do that. The Lo Nechlek Behem Adam Me'olam. No one ever disagreed with them. It's just something which was accepted. Where do they come from? Since the Lo Nuchel of Arer Me'eziz Man Ba'u, we can't specifically attribute them to a specific time or rabbi. So, Ba'olein, where they came to us. We don't know exactly when these gezeros were made. We'll believe something, he said, it's very clear. Kulam Ba'olein min habayis have been based in Hagadol. What's the based in Hagadol? The Sanhedrin. Meaning, the Stam Mishnayos come to us from way back. Rebbe didn't make them up. He took, we saw already, from existing material, and he put it in the Mishnah, and sometimes these Stam Mishnayos were psakim that came to us from the Sanhedrin, asher nigzru mehem b'ma'amad shalem, and they were made during the Second Temple period. Maybe even earlier. Let me give you an example that we saw earlier, not in this semester, but last, in Eidei Mekoma. You know, Eidei Mekoma that we read in the, in Shacharis, it appears in Shacharis with all the korbanos. You know what I'm talking about? People skip it. You know, one of my rabbonim, rather wittily quips, when people come late to shul, the first thing they sacrifice is the korbanos. Who's got a siddur? Who's got a siddur? Anyone got a siddur? Hi, come in. You joining us?
Yeah.
Excellent. I can see you have relations here.
Yes, I do.
Protexia. Excellent. Excellent. Very good. We're just getting ourselves started here.
Thank you.
Okay.
So, truth is, this is going to take me too long to work out what's going on here. I'm not going to start with it here. Here, Korbanos.
Yeah.
For some reason called Karbanos. Okay, far. Yeah, but it's not spelled like that in English either. So, if you look at the end of Korbanos, here I am flicking forward on the phone here, on Joy's phone, it says the following. When it gets to the Korban Chatas, it says, V'ne'echolim, these Korbanos can be eaten, lifnim min ha'kalayim, within the curtains. Inside the curtains, outside the curtains. Which curtains? Where are the curtains in the Beis HaMikdash?
Were they curtains?
The chaser
parochet is not the relevant curtain here.
The curtains were only in the Mishkan. In the Mishkan they had curtains. So why is the Mishnah referring to outside the curtains, inside the curtains? So you could turn around and say, well, this was like the code word for inside the chaser, outside the chaser. They called it the curtains, although there weren't any curtains. Or you could say, no, this Mishnah is actually coming from a time when there were curtains. Meaning, this is very old. And it's coming, and it's been preserved in that Lashon, because that was the, if you like, the text that people were used to, and therefore that got placed into the Mishnah in that way. Therefore, when Rebbe put together the Mishnah, it wasn't a completely new work. It was a patchwork which he edited and created and included opinions here and opinions there, etc., etc. Yes, Dvorah. Right, so we're saying that there may have been some oral texts that go back all the way, that nothing was an oral text. That's interesting. Maybe this shows that there were some oral texts that come from before. That's also something I was thinking. And I keep saying every question you ask, I was thinking as I asked the question. I'm not just saying that, but you keep preempting the questions. It's very good. So I don't know the answer to that question. It may be that shows that maybe there was some old oral text before the full thing was textualized. I'm not sure. Yes.
But I know that the Yehuda and Nasi didn't do it all themselves, but how can you decide to edit and say, I'm going to put...
That's the same question that you asked 5 minutes ago, which we haven't answered yet. Wait, hold your horses.
Like, how can you just do it in general?
Wait. By the way, Boralea, it could be that's a riot against the idea that the curtains means the curtains, but that it was just a code phrase for the area. It could be that, because that's argued both ways. Now, perfect example, number 5. The Gemara says, man tana midas. Some of you are a bit confused by this. It doesn't mean who is a tana with good midas. I mean, who taught Masechet Midot? Masechet Midot is one of the Masechets, we'll see him soon. Who taught that? Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Meaning, the entire book of Masechet Midot was the Mishnah of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, just lifted by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi from the text that they had and popped into the Mishnah. The entire Masechet is like that. So, we see that already. Also, there are guidelines that the Gemara gives to who the Stam Mishnah is, which Shitot they follow. This number 7 is very important to remember, because when you're learning, it'll help you. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, look at number 7. Stam Masnisin Rabbi Meir. The Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. We'll see soon how all these people fit together. In other words, when a Mishnah appears in a Stam form, that's probably the Shita of Rabbi Meir, but it's produced and recorded in a Stam format. To show this authority. Stam Tosefta. What's the Tosefta? We haven't learned about it yet, but does anyone know? What's the Tosefta? Stuff left out of the Mishnah, which was collected into a separate book. It's not all the Brightons. No. It's a subset of the Brightons. We'll talk about Tosefta. Stam Tosefta, Rabbi Nechemia. Stam Sifra. What's the Sifra? Anyone know? The halachic medrash on Vayikra is Rabbi Yehuda. Stam Sifrei, that is the halachic medrash on Bamidbar in Devarim, is Rabbi Shimon. But Kulu Aliba the Rabbi Akiva, but ultimately all of them are following Rabbi Akiva. And this is what we need to talk about Rabbi Akiva. Because we talk about Hillel and Shammai, just think of the time frame, think of the timeline. Hillel and Shammai living just before the destruction of the Second Temple. And then you have, that's why I keep giving you these generations of the Tanaim. Look for a second at, so that you can see how it works. Look at page 5 for a second.
I want you to get an understanding and remember this. I know there are names and things, but you need to, this is too important to forget. If you look at the generations of the Tanaim, the Hillel and Shammai were just, if you like, the last of the Zugos that we talked about last time. So the Tanaim, 5 generations. The first generation is Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, Rabban Gamliel, etc. Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai that we talked about last time. The second generation was Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Shua, that we also talked about last time. And then the third generation, which is Rabbi Akiva, he is really the foundation
of all of the Torah Sheba'al Peh in many ways that we have. Because all of these, stand this, stand this, stand this, all of these were students of Rabbi Akiva. Understand this and understand it well, because this will help you understand why we get so upset about Rabbi Akiva's students dying. Think about this. You know this whole Torah that they teach every year between Pesach and Shavuos? Why is there a time of quasi-mourning because the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died? You know what I'm talking about, right? So like, okay, that's sad. But unfortunately, in the Jewish people, in the last 2,000 years, we've had a lot of worse things that have happened at other times of the year than the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. Why are we so upset about the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva that every year we have to have this new thing for us? I meant Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. So understand like this, okay? Let's do it in Hebrew, it's easier. Okay? You have this massive machlokes between Beit Hillel, okay, and Beit Shammai, okay? You have this incredible machlokes between the two. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, if you like, let's maybe do it this way. The ultimate Rabbi Yehoshua, and here's Rabbi Eliezer, meaning this big machloikas between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer that we talked about. Remember when Rabbi Eliezer said, if the halakha is like me, let the walls prove it. You know what I'm talking about. We did this last time, right?
Did we talk about this last time?
Yeah. And we talked about it in another four as well. So why is Rabbi Yeshua so hard on Rabbi Eliezer? They put him in Cherem, everything he ever gave a hesher to, they traced up, etc. Because he's trying to resurrect this nightmare scenario of civil war, Jewish halachic civil war between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Rabbi Eliezer is trying to reignite that by saying, I'm not following the majority and I even have God on my side. Everyone thinks they have God on their side, right, if they want to start a battle. So Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer had this massive like blow up on that. Their student collectively was Rabbi Akiva. Okay? Rabbi Akiva is the student of both Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Akiva, if you like, is the synthesis. He is the new hope for a united Jewish front. Okay? A united Jewish halachic position is Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva's academy, when he starts teaching that Torah to his Talmidim, Rabbi Akiva's not just another rabbi. Rabbi Akiva is the new beginning of Torah Sheba'al Peh, if you like, in a unified way. So when all his Talmidim die, this is a disaster. Because what's going to be now? Are we going to have another civil war? And they even died, by the way, according to some, in the civil war against the Romans. They went with the Hadrianic persecutions and the Bar Kokhba revolt. Rabbi Akiva was, of course, a supporter of Bar Kokhba. We know that he thought he was the potential Mashiach. And therefore, Rabbi Akiva's students were caught up in the politics and the war, etc. What's going to be now that Rabbi Akiva's students have died? Is this going to turn into an internal Jewish conflict? Have a look at Rabbi Akiva. Have a look at the top of page 8. Let's look for the next 6 or 7 sources. Page 2. And let's look at the Rabbi Akiva and see how this works. Rabbi Akiva was a great organizer. He's a great compartmentalizer. Have a look at number 8. Zeh Rabbi Akiva shehitkin midrash halachot hagadot. It says about the Talmud about Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, that he was a matakein. What's a matakein? He sorted things out. He fixed things up. Have a look at number 9. These are just sound bites. Kashahai Rabbi Akiva masader halachot. He was a masader. What's a masader? An organizer. He was a matakein. He was a masader. Says the Gemara in Gittin, Rabbi Akiva, Oitzer Balom. Oitzer Balot and Oitzer is a storehouse. Balom means organized. So Rashi says a beautiful thing in number 11. And this is really critical, probably the most important source on the sheet. Oitzer Balom, what does it mean he was an organized storehouse? Says Rashi. Kach Mufurish Ba'avos to Rabbi Nathan. This is how it's explained in the Avot of Rabbi Nathan. What's the Avot of Rabbi Nathan? Does anyone know? It's a parallel text to Pirkei Avot. Everyone knows Pirkei Avot? In the Mishnah. There's another Pirkei Avot, the Avot of Rabbi Nathan, which covers similar kind of material, which is not in the Mishnah, but we have the book, I have a book at home, a copy of it at home, and he quotes now from it as follows. Lemaha Rabbi Akiva Doima, what was Rabbi Akiva similar to? La'ami, to a poor person, he's going to give a moshel. Shenotl Kupasa, he picks up his basket, Vayatza Lasada, he goes to the field. Matzah Sa'irim, he finds a bit of barley, Katsa, he cuts it. But Nasanba, he throws it in the basket. Matachitin, he finds a bit of wheat. Nasanba, he puts it in the basket. V'chein pulim, peas. V'chein adashim, lentils. You're getting a little lesson in how to pick vegetables. So when he gets back home, birer, he does borer, obviously not on Shabbos. Kol minu min la'atzmai, he sorts each separate thing into its own compartment. And then they have separate, if you like, vegetables. Kach Rabbi Akiva, so too Rabbi Akiva is the Nimshal, Kishalamad Miraboisa, when he first learns as a young man, and don't forget Rabbi Akiva was a late starter. He was not trained until he was 14 and he's picked it up. Yeah, something like that. I take sucker from that, you know, 40, I'm 46, so you know, if Rabbi Akiva started at 40, there's hope yet. Okay. But he lived till he was 120, and you can't always guarantee that. Okay, Shemadava Mikra, he learned some sukim, Miraboisa, from his rabbis. Va'achrav Halacha, he learned Halacha. Va'achrav Medrash, and he learned Medrash. Va'achrav Agada, and he learned the Agadata. By the way, Medrash here means Halachic Medrash. What do I mean by Halachic Medrash? Not Agadic Medrash. What does the word Drash literally mean? Well, not literally. But what is Drash?
Exegesis.
Okay, drash means, we saw this, right?
Fishbowl.
What?
Your fishbowl diagram.
It's my fishbowl diagram.
Oh, it's only half
the fishbowl. It's only
half
a fishbowl.
Hi.
Hi, more visitors? How exciting. Okay, please come in. This is the time of year, isn't it?
I'm going to make it a bit warmer. Can I make it a bit cooler? Is that okay?
Yeah, now
it's getting a little bit warm. Would you mind sharing this is my last one? We're just on source number 11. What is drash? Drash is where you take halakha and you learn it from a pasuk. You take a pasuk.
We'll share.
No, someone has to share either way. So you take a verse in the Torah. This is a verse in the Torah, a pasuk, and you learn out from it something. Exegesis, as you quite correctly said, exegesis, literally learning out. There's halachic medrash, where you learn halacha, and there's agadic medrash, agadasa, okay, agadasa is just the Aramaic word. There's agadic medrash, meaning if you need to learn halacha, this is what we taught, normally call midrashim. When people talk about midrashim, they kind of mean stories. We haven't talked about midrash yet in this class. We will have a whole session, probably two, maybe three, on how to learn midrash and what midrash is. This kind of midrash, which is really important because people get this wrong. Okay. But there's also halachic medrash. Fine. So, Rabbi Akiva, we're in the second line of the third line. So, Achrav Midrash, Achrav Agada. Nasan libu lachzor aleihem. He put his mind to learn all of them. Ulagor some and to be able to say them over. Actually, how you sedurim with people until he just knew how to say them all. The Loyama, he didn't say, Amud Mikra la'atzmai. I only want to learn Chumash for a while. Midrash la'atzmai, then Midrash for itself. So in other words, at the beginning when he learned, he was like this farmer who throws everything into the basket, all kind of, in England we'd say, higgledy-piggledy, okay? You probably don't say that, but you know what it means, okay? Kashenase chacham gadol, when he became a great rabbi, so what did he do? Asa kol ha-Torah matbeot, and this is a key thing. He turned the Torah into matbeot. What's a matbea? A coin. What is the shoresh of the word matbea?
Teva.
What does that mean? I know you're going to say nature, yeah. But why is nature called teva? What does teva actually mean?
Yeah. Order.
That's also what it means here, like compartmental. But what is it? Litvoa, tovea bayam.
To drown.
Matbea is called a matbea because it sinks in. It sinks. If your ship is tovea, it means it's sinking. A matbea is a coin because in English, even American English, we also use this phrase to coin a phrase. This word is to coin. What does it mean to coin a phrase? How is a phrase coined? It's not used. It's fixed. That's what it means to fix. Matbea is something which is imprinted. Teva is called teva because it's fixed and it works like clockwork. It's finished and it's done and it's printed into nature. Therefore, a matbeah is a coin because you take a piece of metal and you stamp something in it and that's it's fixed now. It's not going to change. So, Rabbi Akiva did this, what I called last time, textualization. He turned this amorphous mass of halacha into matbeot. Mary had a little lamb. And you know that Mary had a little lamb. A dog is a man's best friend. These are all matbeot. These are matbeot. So in Halacha, Lahavdil, he turned the Torah into bite-sized chunks. When do you say this? When do you say that? Etc. And now we have Mishnayot. Rabbi Akiva really produced this. Sider. He organized Midrash, Sifrei, Sifra, Levadan, all these things separately. V'shan al atzman l'talmidim, and he taught them separately to his talmidim. The halachas la'atzman, halachas separately, agadas la'atzman. So what you now have, I'm going to draw you another diagram now. Get rid of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua for a second. What you now have is a system whereby Torah Shebal Peh is compartmentalized. This is why Rabbi Akiva is the great compartmentalizer. So if you like, you have, okay, oral law, which was non, if you like, compartmentalized. And now you have different types. You have halakha, which was turned into a book, which we call the Mishnah. You have Agadah, which was turned into, like, the Midrash Rabbah, for example. Midrash Rabbah, things like that. You have Kabbalah, which turns into the Zohar. And I'm not getting into the whole debate as to exactly where the Zohar came from and who wrote it and how. That's for another discussion, which is not for now. Although I'm well aware of that debate, and don't worry about that for now. But he compartmentalizes things, and that's how we ended up with the halachic structure that we have today. Okay? And Rabbi Akiva was one of the main people. Now, I mentioned his students. Here, look at number 12. This is the source in Yevamos that deals with that famous event. Amru Shnayim Asa Elef Zugim. There were 12,000 chavruses of Talmidim, higher than Rabbi Akiva. Okay? Migvat ad Antipras, this place, from there to there. Kulam Mesa Beperikecha. They all died in one period. Because they didn't have cover for each other, I'm not getting into that. Now, the world was desolate. Why was the world desolate? Meaning nobody else knew Torah. These were the only 12,000 chavrusas that knew Torah. Because, like I said before, this was the great new hope. Rabbi Akiva is a synthesis of Beis Hillel Shammai. Rabbi Akiva took himself to the south, started up again. V'shan alehem, and he taught a small group of new Rebbeim, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, that's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, the Heim Hemidu Torah Oisasha. They are the people that, if you like, re-establish the Torah. And therefore, if you look through the Mishnayot, and you look at the individual names which are quoted, these are the people more than anybody else that is quoted. The most quoted Tana in the Mishnah is... Anyone know? Rabbi Yehuda. Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, so I suppose anonymously, Rabbi Meir does get brought most because Stam Mishnah is like Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda is the most quoted individual. Rabbi Yossi comes second. Rabbi Shimon, I believe, comes third. These are the classics of the Mishnah. They were all the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, and therefore these were the new synthesis, if you like. After the Talmidim died, these were the new group that started that off. Look at these very quick sources, 13 through 15. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Zot Mishnah Rabbi Akiva, Aval Mishnah Rishon. In other words, Rabbi Akiva's Mishnah is separate from the Mishnah Rishon, and we saw that before. The Fikach was shown in Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer. We had Rabbi Eliezer's Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. We saw this before. These are all different Mishnahs, which all merge into eventually Mishnah Rabbi Akiva. Now, our Mishnah today comes after that. Our Mishnah was put together by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in around about the year 200, roughly. How was that done? Let's have a look now at the Mishnah itself and the compilation of the Mishnah. Look at the source on the bottom of the page, which says 15, but it should be 16. Rebbe, the Rebbe Nosson Seif Mishnah. Rebbe, now Rebbe is the shorthand for Rebbe Yehuda Anossi, and Rebbe Nosson, we already saw the Avo is the Rebbe Nosson, that's his colleague. They are the end of the Mishnah. What does that mean, they're the end of the Mishnah? So flip over to page 3. I'm not going to read every one of these sources, but basically let's start with Rashi, and I'll summarize some of the others. Seif Mishnah. Seif Tanaim. That was the end of the Tanaim. What does the word Tana literally mean?
Teacher.
Exactly. Seif Tanaim. And you may him, says Rashi, until then, Amru Ish Es Dvarav Bebeis HaMadrash. Each person said their view in the Bet Midrash. Bahayu Talmidim Gorasim Shmua Shmua Levada. And people would learn individual, if you like, segments, individual teachings of different rabbis. The loy hayu masechdot seduot. They weren't separate masechtas. What's a masechta? You've all heard of Masechta because people learn Masechtas of Gemara, Mishnayos. What does the word Masechta literally mean? Tractate. That's how it's always translated into English, right? But nobody knows what the word tractate actually means. Masechta comes from some kind of a word dealing with a weave or a loom. It's a bit like the English word folio, like for a leaf kind of thing. But Masechta means basically a book, a tractate, a book, individual book of Mishnayot. So he organized this, the Masechtas. Okay, the Sider, the Kibetz ala Seder, and he organized the Sidarim, he organized the order of Mishnahs. The Chem Kallu Ha'amu B'Dorah Shelifneim, they included everything in previous Dorahs. The Sidru et the Masechtas, they organized the Masechtas for Achreihem Lo Yosifu Ela Ma'at. But after them, there was only a very little added. Listen to those three last few words of Rashi. After the Mishnah, he says, very little was added. What does that mean? Look, how big is the Mishnah? If I put it all together in one book, it's about, you can get it in a book this big. How big is the Gemara? So, what's he mean? After the Mishnah, very little was added. The Mishnah is like 1/30th of the size of the Gemara. So he means that in terms of principles of halacha, it's all in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is everything constricted and contracted, condensed into the most, you know, condensed form of words you can. The Gemara is just really there to explain what the Mishnah means. Very little was added in terms of real principles of Jewish law after the Mishnah. Everything's in the Mishnayos. The Gemara is really Peirush. It adds a few things here and there, but really very, very little. Yes?
So we learned, after any Sefer Halacha or any time it, like, is over and the book is codified, you can no longer add to it. So that's why Amorim can't argue on time, because the Mishnah was already codified by their time, so they can't, like, be quoted. They can just, if a talk was made in the Mishnah, none of the Amorim can argue on it. They can only say, well, yeah, because this is already,
right, right.
And then once, we can't be quoted on the Gemara anymore because, we're so much later.
The question is why? What creates that binding nature? And that we have to talk about, which is the Chatimah HaShem. Why is it that you can't go beyond certain lines? That the Amoraim don't argue with Tanaim, and that the Rishonim don't argue with the Gemara. Why is that? We're going to have to look at that. Because it's not so straightforward. Because there is another principle in Halacha that seems to go against that, which is, given the choice between the earlier and the later authorities, the Halacha always follows the later authorities over the earlier authorities. So, how do those two things fit together? Because if you're following the later ones, they should override. We're going to have to talk about that. And that is, I think, sheet 39, 4, something like that. You're thinking a few sheets ahead. What was this process of the Mishnah? Everybody, numbers 19, 20, and 21 are just three different accounts by three different important people. 19 is the Igeret of Rav Shrira Gaon, which we've mentioned once or twice before, but never, I think, in the last few sessions. Who is Rav Shrira Gaon? One of the Gaonim, yeah, you got that. He's on the Who's Who. No photographs, I'm afraid, because he lived in the 10th century. But Rav Shrira Gaon, basically, was one of the last of the Gaonim. His son was Rav Hai Gaon. You've heard of Rav Hai Gaon? They were father-son team. They both lived to an incredible age. They both lived to the middle of 100 or over 100. So they spanned quite a long period. But Rav Shrira Gaon was the first person, really, to set down an account of Torah Shebaal Peh. He wrote this Igeret, this letter. The people sent him a question, how is it that the Gemara works like this, it's structured like that. He wrote down this Igeret, and we get a lot of our information from the Igeret of Rav Shrira Gaon, which you can go out to a shop and buy. You can buy, I have one at home in English translation. It's not something which we've lost, we have it in full. So I brought you the Igeret of Rav Shrira Gaon. I also brought you Rashi, which is the one I will read. And I brought you the Hagdam of the Rambam to the Yad HaZaka. Which is also very important as well. They all basically say the same kind of thing with nuances, which is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi saw a window of opportunity, which was what? Think about the timeline. This is why I gave you, just look for a second over the page at page 4 of the timeline. If you look at Bar Kochba, think about this as follows. The temple was destroyed in which year? 70. That should be imprinted on your mind. You know that already. The matzav of the Jewish people after the destruction of the temple was bad, but it wasn't terrible. Meaning, the Jews still lived in Yerushalayim. They may have even brought korbanos in the destroyed temple. That's an interesting question as to whether they did or whether they didn't. But there was not a wholesale dissolution of the whole system. When Bar Kochba rebelled against the Romans in the 120s, So he lost that rebellion, although it was a close thing at times. Hadrian put down that rebellion so, if you like, conclusively, that that was it. He ploughed over Har Habayis. Everything that was there was totally destroyed. He built a Roman, a pagan temple there. The Jews were expelled from Jerusalem. In other words, it was actually, in many ways, much worse and more final than the destruction of the temple itself. The Bar Kokhba revolt was absolutely devastating. Rabbi Akiva was killed, of course, in the Bar Kokhba revolt. There was a mass uprising. When Hadrian won that rebellion, he clamped down very hard on the Jewish people. Many of them fled, actually, to Babel. Many of the rabbis fled east, up northeast, up to Babel. About 60 or 70 years later, there was a brief period of calm. There was this Roman proconsul or emperor, wherever you understand it, called Antoninus. They talk a lot about Antoninus. I think that's a glorious name, actually, Antoninus, for all sorts of personal reasons. Antoninus and Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi were extremely close. And they, in fact, Chazal used them as the example of Yaakov and Esav able to actually work together. Okay? And Antoninus, whoever he was, and there's a suggestion he was Marcus Aurelius, who was known to be a very erudite and intellectual Roman emperor compared to most of the rest of them. I'm not getting into the history of it. But there was a period which Antoninus was relatively calm. And he relaxed many of the decrees against the Jewish people. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi basically realized that if it's not now, then maybe it'll be never. This could be the last time that we ever really get a calm period in Eretz Israel to put this Mishnah to rest, to really put this Mishnah to bed and get it all sorted out. And that's what they did. In the end, he was right, because when Marcus Aurelius died and the next people took over, and the next people took over, it just went downhill from there, till eventually, in the 4th century, the Roman Empire became Christian. Once it became Christian, then the Jewish situation was basically finished. Because the Romans were anti-Jewish for political and military reasons. They didn't want another uprising in another province. The Christians, of course, were anti-Jewish for deep theological, religious reasons. You know, we killed their Messiah, and therefore they're not going to let that go, even if we promise to be good boys and girls. And therefore, once the Roman Empire became Christian, that was basically the end, and everybody left and went to Babel. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi actually turned out to be correct. Don't worry about that. It does that every now and then. It's quite safe. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi turned out to be correct. This indeed was one of the last periods that we could do this. Look at Rashi for a second, and then I'll have a look at the Mishnah itself with you. Look at Rashi number 20. Lefisha Mishurabu Tamidi Shammai VeHillel. When Shammai and Hillel, the Tamidim Shammai and Hillel, became so many, Shehayu Lefanav Shloisha Doiras. There were three generations before this already. Rabu Machlekes B'Torah V'Nasis K'Shtei Torahs. The Torah began to split into two Torahs. There was mamash a civil war. Mitoich Oh, Shibud Malchus, because of the persecutions of the Romans, of Gezeira Shahai Gozan Aleim, which told Tachloi Hayucholim Letet Leiv Levarer Divrei Hacholkin. They couldn't really focus, they couldn't get it right, they couldn't learn it properly. Adyam of Sharabi, up until the time of Rebbe. Shinatan HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lochein Be'enei Antoninus Melech Romi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, some chain, some, how do you translate chain? Some grace, some favor in the eyes of Antoninus. And they had a brief respite from the hardships. The Shalach, and he sent out the Kavetz, and he gathered together Kol Tamid Eretz Yisrael, all the Tamidim of Eretz Yisrael, for the Adyam of Loi Hayu Masechta Siduras, until his time there were no organized Masechtas of Mishnah, and a Kol Tamid Shasham Adav Mipi Gadol Heimenu Gar. So everyone learned their own teachings, if you like. V'nasna Siman. Halacha Kaplan, he gave Simanim, he gave signs in the Mishnah. Halacha Kaplanis. Or plainis shemati mishum plainis, that each halacha is attributed to the right name. When they all got together in this massive academy, each one gave over his masorah, what they'd heard. And they unraveled everything, all the reasons for the machlokas, divrei mi roi and lekayim, who should we keep, who should we reject. Vesidru hamasechtas, and he put together the masechtas of the Mishnah. Divrei Nezikin Levadam, he put Nezikin separately. Yevamos Levadam, Hervamos separately. Divrei Kodshim Levadam, etc., etc. Vesasam Nami B'Mishnah, he also brought in Stam Mishnahs. Divrei Yechidim, Shira Rebbe Es Divreihem, when he felt that he wanted to pass in their way, Vashanan Stam, he just taught them Stam. And so that would be the halacha, like we said before. That's what happened in terms of the Mishnah. Now look at the structure of the Mishnah itself. Have a look at page 4 for a second. Again. Sorry to have you running back and forth, but look at this chart. Now you don't need to make notes about all of this, because let me tell you what I've given you here. At the bottom of page 4, which you need to turn this way as you have, I've brought you the structure, the tree diagram, if you like, of the Mishnah. At the top of page 5, which you don't need to look at right now, but you can if you like, I've brought you a summary of what each Masechta in the Mishnah is really about. So even though I'm about to talk about a few of them now, you don't have to write it down because it's all written down there. Okay? But the Mishnah basically works like this, and this you need to know. And you can go and look at it afterwards and browse upstairs in the Beit Midrash. The Mishnah is divided into 6 Sedarim, 6 orders of Mishnah. Zra'im, Mo'ed, Nashim, Nezikim, Kodshim, and Tarot. Okay? And it's very logical, and this is how it works. Zra'im literally means seeds, which deals with all the agricultural laws. And he produced in there like 11 or 12 Masechtot. Brachot, of course, deals with the brachot you make on the food before you eat it. And in there he put the halachas of tefillah, and halachas of all the brachas, etc. And kriyashma, davening. Pe'ah is, see how good your general Jewish knowledge is. Pe'ah is believing in the core of the field. Demai, you won't know what that is. Do you know what demai is?
Positively,
oh, very good, very good. I shouldn't have doubted you for a second. Demai is when you don't know if Trumas and Masas have been taken from this produce and how you deal with that suffix. Kilayim is
mixtures
of different things, whether it's shatners, whether it's animals who are mixed together when they're shackled together, or whether it's plants grown together. Shviit, Shemitah year. Trumas, Masas, Masasheni. Chala, these are all different kinds of Masas that you take on food. Orla, the first years of the tree, and Bikurim, which is the fruit you bring to the Beit HaMikdash. This is all the agricultural laws, all in separate Masechtas. He created the Masechtas. Moed is the easiest. It's the easiest to learn, by the way, and it's very simple to understand. Moed just means the holidays, the meeting places, if you like. Shabbos and Erev are really part of the same idea, but he split them into two, otherwise it would have been just gigantic. Okay? Pesachim deals with Pesach, why plural? Pesach Rishon, Pesach Sheni, correct. Shkolim deals with the contributions, the chetzi shekel that they brought for each of the chagim that they brought to the Beit Mikdash, etc. Or they brought once a year, but they came in the chagim and they brought different things. Yuma is the day Yom Kippur. Sukkah is Sukkah. Beitza is really Yom Tov. It just begins with the word Beitza. Rosh Hashanah is Rosh Hashanah. Tanis is all the different fast days and also fast that they decreed for lack of rain. Megillah deals with Megillas Esther and Purim. Moed Katan is, what's the little holiday? Chol HaMoed. And it also includes the laws of mourning. You're reading from there, I see. Yeah. Chagiga is the offering that they brought. What's missing? The offering they brought in Yom Tov. What's missing?
Where's the second Chanukah? This is one of the imponderable questions of the Mishnah.
In Shabbos.
The details they brought in Shabbos. Who said that? Yeah. The details are brought there in Shabbos. Absolutely. My Chanukah. What is Chanukah? He brings all the halachos there. Why not have a little Masechet Chanukah, one or two prokim? You could make some, you could find something to say. So one answer is that he didn't want to start getting it because the Hashmonaim should have given over to Yehuda and they were Kohenim. So that's like funny reason for him not to include a Masechet, but they say that. One reason I heard, I think from Rav Reuven Margolis, is that the whole Mishnah project was undertaken under the supervision of the Romans. It says that explicitly in the Gemara Sanhedrin. The Romans had people checking what we were writing. And Chanukah was like a red rag to a bull. Chanukah to the Romans? You're going to start talking about Yehuda and Maccabee? You're going to start a whole new rebellion. They just got over the last one, the Bar Kokhba, so they didn't want to start making trouble with the Romans. That could be a reason. But even that reason is like, that's a reason not to have a Masechta. There's no Masechta Chanukah, whatever reason. Nashim deals with the relationship between men and women, which obviously Yevamos and Ksubos. Yevamos is marrying the brother-in-law and how that works. Ksubos is the financial relationships between the husband and wife. Nedarim is oaths largely between husbands and wives. That's where it appears in the Torah. Nazir is a subset of oaths. That's why it appears there, because it's a kind of oath you make as a Nazir, although it's got nothing specifically to do with women and men. Either women or men can be a Nazir. Sota, obviously, has the implications between husband and wives. Gittin, divorce, kiddushin, marriage. By the way, why are these things in this order? You would have thought Kiddushin would come first, then, like, I'll tell you in a minute. Nezikin means damages. And here you have Bava Kama Bava Masir Bava Basra. They were all originally one big Masechta. They were split. What is Bava Basra, Bava Kama Bava Basra? It just means part one, part two, part three. Okay? That's what it means. Sanhedrin deals with the court structure. Makkas, which was originally part of Sanhedrin, deals with specific court punishments. Shavuos means promises or oaths, deals with oaths that you give in court. Eduyot, a different testimony, is that of halacha that were given different times in the past, different time of Tanaim. Avodah Zarah speaks for itself. Pirkei Avos, interesting, why is it in Zikin? Not for now, but Pirkei Avos is there as well. And Horayot is when the Beis Din HaGadol makes a mistake, and how you deal with mistaken rulings by the Beis Din, and what the implications of that are. Kodshim means... Kodshim?
Holy
things, meaning... Korbanot. And you've got the obvious examples. Zvachim are all the meaty korbanos. Menachot are all the veggie korbanos. Yeah? Flour, oil, things like that. Chulin means all the chol meat. Chulin just means chol. The Arabic word for chulin is halal. That's where halal meat comes from. Chulin just means non-kodshim. Bechorot is a kind of korban, the firstborn. Arachin are the different valuations that a person could pledge to the Beit HaMikdash, the value of this, the value of that. Tamura is when you switch one korban for another. Krisus is for different kinds of chiyuvei kores, and the thing and how you bring that with a korban, chatas, etc. Me'ila is where you misuse or abuse temple property. Talmud talks about the daily routine of the public korbanos. Midot is a description of, we saw the second midot we referred to before, right? Is a description of the, how the Beit HaMikdash is laid out. And kinim, what's kinim? And don't say lies.
Birds. What's birds have to do anything?
The korbanos that a woman would bring after she gave birth, which were two birds. And most, for anyone who wants to be an actuary,
Masechta Kinim or life's map,
Masechta Kinim is going to be your dream Masechta. Why? Because Masechta Kinim deals with all the variations and combinations that can happen when birds from one person's sacrifice fly into someone else's. Why? Because if you're bringing sheep and cows, you can usually keep track of them. You know, hold on to your sheep, and it's not likely to... And by the way, one cow and another cow, you know, you can tell this is my cow, this is your cow. But birds, maybe to other birds look different. But to human beings, birds are birds. So when you have thousands of women in the Beis HaMikdash, all with two little turtle doves, and then they look around for 3 minutes and... And the whole Masechta is dealing with probabilities and combinations. It's either you love it or it does your head in. But it's a fascinating Masechta. Taras deals with the issues of Tumah and Tara, which we don't have so much today, which Kalim is every single possible combination and permutation of vessels and tables and chairs and clothes and tools which could become Tamei in different ways. We think of Kalim as pots and pans, but Kalim doesn't, these are also Kalim. These are Kalim and the chairs are Kalim, etc. Olos deals with dead bodies in tents and how you deal with that if you're going to not become Tamei. Nega'im is Tzara'at. Para is Paraduma. Taras is assorted halachas of Tumah and Tara. Mikvah is how to build your local mikvah. Nida obviously is halachas relating to a woman who's having her menstrual cycle. Machshirin is when a food became wet, then it was able to contract Tumah, Machshirin, and the halachas of that. Zavim deal with people, men and women, who have unfortunate things flowing from their bodies that shouldn't be because they're sick. Either a male or a female. Tful Yom is someone who went to the mikveh that day and is waiting for the sunset, and all the halachas yadayim, and the halachas of tilish yadayim for different things, and uksin, the halachas of food, little stems on the food, and at what point the food stops and the stem starts, etc., etc. Now, that's the Mishnah in a nutshell. That's the quickest overview of the Mishnah you're ever going to get. Rabbi Huda Hanasi, and I'm not going through this now, but Source 24 said this, he organized the Masechta Yehot.
We were cold before. Sorry, we've got 5 minutes to go.
You can never get it right in here. He organized the Masechtas, but he didn't organize the Sedarim, meaning within one Masechta, he put the order together, or they put the order together, and that's very important, because sometimes the order within a Masechta is important to the Halacha. If you have a Stam Mishnah, then a Machloikas, or you have a Machloikas, then a Stam. But the general order of how the Sedarim are set out was done later, was not done by him. How are the Sedarim generally laid out? It's actually very simple, from biggest to smallest. In almost every one of the Sedarim, if you take Moed for example, Shabbos has 24 chapters, Erevin has a bit less, until Chagiga has 3, and they generally go from the biggest, and they go down to the smallest. Okay? It's as simple as that. And the order, if you like, is not that relevant, except within a Masechta itself, the Prakim. So you have Sedarim, Masechtas, Prakim, and Mishnayot. Okay?
Not within the Seder.
Within the Seder, the order is not relevant.
No, not the order, but did he make the...
No, not necessarily. Sedarim? No. Yes. He made the six Sedarim. Hillel already made the six Sedarim.
And but he said which Masechta were in which, but he didn't like order.
Correct.
Them.
Absolutely correct. The last couple of things, and we didn't answer the Diva's question yet. We must, otherwise she'll be very unhappy with me. But just look for a second on page 6. I've brought you some interesting stuff here. There are all sorts of programs whereby you can learn the entire Mishnah in different lengths of time. And as I said to you at the beginning, it's a very recommended thing to do because Mishnayos really give you an overview of Torah Shebaal Peh. The top chart is you can learn the entire Mishnah in 1 month if you learn 18 parakim a day. And this is just a division from Aleph to Chaf Tet of how you can learn the entire Mishnah. And I know people who do this. It is like marathon running. You know, 18 parakim of Mishnah. Put it this way. If I gave you an unseen Mishnah that you hadn't learned before, you probably take 20 to 30 minutes to unravel one Mishnah. Okay? Now, a chapter typically has 7 or 8, 10 Mishnayos in it. So 18 chapters is around 150 to 180 Mishnayos. So think about doing that every day. So obviously, by the time you've done them 100 times, it's like you can chazer them in no time at all. But that's how you marathon run through Mishnayos. If you look at the table on the left-hand side, so you can see how many Prakim and how many Mishnayos are in each Seder. So Zeroyim has 75 Prokim, Moed has 88, etc. If you see Kochim and Tarath and Mammoth, they're very big, with 91 and 126. And there at the bottom it tells you if you want to learn 70 missions a day, how long it's going to take. If you learn 18 Prokim a day, it takes you a month. If you learn a Perik and a half a day, it takes you a year. So eventually if you learn like a Mishnah every day, so it'll take you basically 12 years to get through the Mishnahs. And hopefully you've got a lot of staying power, otherwise you're going to fall by the wayside somewhere along the way. So these are all various different combinations, permutations as to how to get through the Mishnah. Now, in the last minute, and in the divine fairness to you, I'll start with this next time. How are they allowed to even do all this? Let me just throw one liner at you. Look at source number 22 for a second. And we'll finish with this. And we'll start with this next time. We said already there was a halachic prohibition to turn the Torah Shebaal Peh into a text. So how are they allowed to do this? They made these matzbeot. So says the Gemara, the Omer. It says in Tehillim, it is a time to act for God because people are breaking the Torah. On a pshat level, it's what it says. Meaning, when you see that people are breaking the Torah, you have to call the call to action. People, it's time to act for God and protect the Torah. Rabbi Nosson, Amar Rabbi Nosson, who was one of the authors of the Mishnah, Rabbi and Rabbi Nosson, Soif Mishnah, Rabbi Nosson says, actually, you know something, halachically we read, on a drash level, we read this pasuk backwards, and say, Heferu Suresecha, the time has arrived to break the Torah, Mishum Eis La'asos Hashem, because we have to act for God. Meaning, that built into the halachic system, says, the Rabbi Nosson here, is like an override button, to be used extremely rarely. It's like got a glass cover on it and a case saying, in the event of emergency, open the glass and smash the case. Meaning, Eis La'asos Hashem Heferu Suresecha means that under certain circumstances, the people who lead Klal Yisrael can say that even though this is strictly speaking Osa, in order to protect the ongoing future of the Jewish people and the Torah itself, we need to break this, we need to change this halacha in order to be able to long term, like amputating a limb in order to save the body. Now, that obviously is a very dangerous weapon. When do you use Eis La'asos Hashem? When do you start pressing this override button and allowing what has not yet been allowed? Classically, it's in order to protect Torah. In this case, it was in order to protect the Torah Shebaal Peh. But there are other examples, and we maybe speak a little bit more about this next time. Because obviously, in the hands of the wrong people, this could be abused enormously. And we have to look at how it's been used over history. Joy, you had a question?
No, I mean, first question with that is like that's so often used as like a justification, especially in like conservative.
Right, 100%. Exactly. This is exactly why I'm saying it is a dangerous blunt weapon. If it's not used precisely and correctly, it can just destroy rather than protect. How this works is, I don't have time for now because it's already out of time, but we will start with this. Be'ezrat Hashem, next time, remind me, Nadiva, you won't forget. Next time to start with this and we'll continue there. Okay, we covered a lot of ground. Baruch Hashem.